This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota via radio this time of day. Today we're going to start our show talking about hunger in North Dakota. It's a problem. It's a problem in the country, and it's a particular problem in parts of North Dakota. And we're going to talk about this with members of the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition. They join us from our studio in Bismarck. Let's say hello to Lori Sapo. She is the Rural Development Director for the North Dakota Association of Rural Electric Co-ops. Thank you for being with us, Lori.
Thank you for having me.
And Karen Ahrens is with you. She's a health and nutrition consultant with Ahrens Consulting, but the important thing is you're both involved in the coalition. Karen, thank you for being with us.
Good day, and thank you for having us.
Who belongs to the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition?
Well, this is Karen. I'm the coordinator for the coalition, so I'll jump in here and tell you about our diverse network of members of people who get food to people in North Dakota. That's all the way from the people who grow our food to the people who help get food to seniors, to children in schools, to people who visit food pantries and soup kitchens, and many places in between.
So, Lori, what is the interest of the rural electric co-ops in this effort?
Well, we are interested in food access across rural North Dakota, and we've been connected with Karen because their concerns are the same. In essence, we're just very concerned about the health and welfare of people in North Dakota.
Your constituents are out there where we're talking about, I take it.
Yes.
How is this coalition funded, Karen?
Well, we are a network, and the North Dakota Department of Health has supported the time for a coordinator ever since the coalition began 10 years ago. And so with that small amount of funding available each year, we help bring the members together, usually on a monthly basis, to learn from each other what's new, find ways that we can work better together, and try to reduce any duplication of effort that might happen.
Well, we're not officially part of the coalition, but Prairie Public and Main Street in particular will be focusing on some of these issues throughout the year, going up to your summit in September, and we'll archive these discussions at podcasts as well so that people can keep track of them. Karen, what are the priorities currently being pursued to achieve the goal of a hunger-free North Dakota?
Well, it's people with the powerful vision of a hunger-free North Dakota. We are a statewide network open to all. And I think our priorities over the last 2 years are focusing on the increasing connections between lack of a secure food source and the health of people. And the people's health is related to their ability to be productive at work, productive at school, for children to learn to their best ability, and for us all to have a strong and healthy state.
Well, we're speaking, of course, from two of the state's biggest cities, Fargo and Bismarck, where there's no lack of access to supermarkets, big grocery stores. But we're going to focus today on the Rural Grocer Initiative, because apparently rural groceries across the state have been diminishing in number. They're down like 15% in the last 5 years. And that, of course, affects people's access to fresh food and that kind of thing, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, about 5 years ago, we started getting phone calls from rural grocery stores just saying, is there any grant money available? We're short operating costs. And that's, I'm a rural development professional. That's not a normal request for help. And, you know, the first grocery store we heard that from, we were a little bit, we were concerned about them. They did end up closing their doors. But we received quite a few phone calls that year asking for help. And so we started thinking something was shifting in that industry or something had changed. A little bit worried that it was population decline and that was the sole reason that they were closing. But we did a little bit of internet research and we started learning that we weren't the only state that was experiencing this, that it was something that was happening across all the rural areas in North Dakota. So we started connecting with our grocery stores to see, you know, what their challenges were and was this a decline that we could verify. And like so many things that decline is silent, and especially in rural areas, you're not realizing what's happening around you when you're operating in your own community and your own main street. And until somebody starts connecting those dots and counting the numbers, you really can't see what's happening. So that was when we realized we had 137 stores 5 years ago, and now we're down to 104.
Well, I can recall when I was a kid, there were actually neighborhood grocery stores, even in large cities, that was the case. Then the supermarkets came, and that changed the sort of the food distribution business in urban areas. But nowadays, I kind of struggle with what is the definition of a grocery store, because you have convenience stores that are gas stations all over the state of North Dakota. How does, Karen, the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition define a grocery store?
Well, let's see. We've discussed that, and I think we've settled upon a place where you can find access to food that is fresh, that a place where you can find vegetables and fruits and things that you take home and cook. And that includes access to dairy products, fresh meat as well. So we have a growing number, or at least a stable number, of places where you can find food that's prepared and processed, and it's fairly cheap and it's easy to come by. But also, when we think of the connections between health and access to food, it's really important that people have access to places where you can get fresh food that you can prepare yourself and control what goes in it.
Well, when we think of fresh food, and, you know, we're also concerned about prices, and I'm looking at my experience driving across North Dakota, stopping perhaps at a convenience store because I can get gasoline there. I go in inside and I see, well, they've got celery. They've got, meat wrapped and frozen and that kind of thing. Has the competition, the kind of the business of meeting the needs of people in a particular part of the state changed, and has that altered whether a standalone grocery store is a viable business, and maybe a co-op gas station and grocery store is the solution?
Yes, price is a very large factor in food access. It's one of the reasons people drive larger distances to get their food is because they are looking for a better price. And that distribution of food, as far as we can tell, is based primarily on volumes purchased. So if you're a smaller grocery store and you're purchasing a smaller volume, your prices are higher. Sometimes they're higher to the point where your wholesale cost is the same as the retail price in a more urban center.
Wow.
You know, our food distributors don't necessarily have defined service territories. There's still competition for certain customers within our rural areas, and our rural areas, the volume's gotten so small that it feels like it's time to start streamlining the movement of that food.
And when we think about food security, we want to make sure that people who don't have access to a vehicle, who may not drive during the winter, who may not drive at night, don't have the means to drive to a larger urban center to purchase their food, also have the access to food nearby where they live.
And, of course, we live in a farm and ranch state where people are probably used to driving a fair amount just to get whatever they need of any sort. But I did go up to your website, hungerfreend.org, and there's a fair amount of information up there. And I was struck by the kind of volume of business that a grocery store needs to conduct in order to be viable. And, you know, there are lots of parts of the state where you'd wonder if that kind of business environment exists.
That was one more aha moment that we had. An average U.S. grocery store has weekly sales of around $320,000 per week.
That's a bunch.
It is. And our average rural grocery stores, the midpoint is right around $20,000 per week. Mm. And so when you try to figure out what the net profit margins are for that really small grocery store versus a more urban store, it's no wonder that we have trouble keeping our stores open.
Is there a part of the state or parts of the state that are in particularly tough situations because of this phenomena, this changing marketplace, this business model that isn't quite working?
When we started mapping the stores and identifying the food desert areas, it does look like the central, kind of eastern central part of the state is the part that's losing more of its grocery stores or has less access to food at this point. I would say also the southwestern part as well.
And, of course, specific populations you've mentioned, you know, older people who may not want to be driving. How about those areas that are, you know, reservation areas, that kind of thing?
Yes. The reservations have a particularly hard time having access to food. Many times the prices there are higher from the supplier than in other parts of the state as well. So it entices people to drive to purchase their food.
Well, let's get to some potential ideas, if you will, for solutions here. This is Karen Ahrens. She's the coordinator for the Hunger Free North Dakota Coalition, and Lori Sopo. She is the Rural Development Director for the North Dakota Association of Rural Electric Co-ops. What can be done to turn this trend around, to get more groceries out to more people?
We don't have that silver bullet answer quite yet, but we have all of these ideas just swimming around in our heads and things that some of them are actually trying to implement at this time. We do wonder whether we can get groups of grocery stores together to start purchasing on a cooperative basis, and we are trying a pilot project in the northeast corner of the state to try to do something like that. When you think of Dollar General stores, the reason they get products so affordably to their stores across our rural areas is because they are buying collectively at the same price. So we're trying to improve their volume and improve their price. And by doing that, maybe get better variety in those stores as well. We're also trying to get the state involved in this and have them look at the policies that are in place that may impact how entities purchase food, such as schools and, you know, some of the programs that are available through our rural grocery stores. Is there ways to enhance those so that people can buy food more affordably? And we are also looking to form a public-private partnership. So, for example, we've been talking to the U.S. Postal Service and wondering if there's a way to partner with them. They're already driving to all of these rural communities. Is there a way to move food to grocery stores as well? Kind of thinking like Amazon. Amazon partnered with existing distribution systems, and they're able to get their product quite affordably to almost everywhere in the nation.
That's what I thought of as soon as you said the Postal Service. I thought this might be their business model adapting as well.
Right.
Well, let's talk about this pilot project that you mentioned that's taking place in Cavalier, Nelson, Pembina, Ramsey, Walsh counties, and the Spirit Lake Reservation. There would be a number of stores. Are they receptive to the idea of forming a cooperative arrangement?
So our initial data showed us that 77% of the businesses in that area understand or are interested in collaborating. However, just like human nature, it's hard to change. So when we got to the point where we were saying, okay, we're moving forward, to this point, people got a little gun-shy. So what we've emerged with, it's in Walsh County. There's a group. It's a four-point hub. So we have one store that's interested in serving as a redistribution site and two other grocery stores that would be distributed to from that grocery store. And then we have, interestingly, one community without a grocery store that we're going to test the financial feasibility of whether we can do a grocery locker system.
And what is a grocery locker system? Is that somebody can – you get access to it if you have a code or something like that?
Right. It's climate controlled, so you can deliver frozen, refrigerated, or dried products to there. You order through your local grocery store. It's either a credit card or SNAP transaction. It's paid for at that time. You're assigned a code. You then the food is delivered to that locker in the other community. The customer can enter their code. And the doors that are holding your grocery items pop open, and you can receive your groceries.
Wow. Shades of the automat from generations ago.
Yes.
Well, how about this involvement of schools? That is intriguing to me because schools, of course, if they have lunch programs and things like that and early school breakfast programs, they're big users of food. So would they potentially be important partners in this in terms of getting distribution interest?
They are. They used to be really good customers of the local grocery stores, and some of them still are. There's been some changes in the regulations on how groceries are purchased, or food is purchased, excuse me, for the schools. And budgets are tighter as well, so they're looking also for good prices. And because of that, some of them are now purchasing through food service distributors versus the grocery store, so they're getting supplied directly. So we're trying to get some of those purchases to start moving through the grocery store again because, as I mentioned earlier, it's all about volume. The higher volume the grocery store has, the more affordable the prices are for everybody.
So you might be talking about some sort of state policy adjustment here for that.
Maybe just a clarification of the policy that's out there and exploring. So there's also other programs that have started purchasing, for example, senior meal programs where seniors come together and eat at a senior center or have their meals delivered to them in some of our rural towns, encouraging them to shop through their rural grocery store. We have another project where we're encouraging and exploring how people who provide childcare to children can also make some of the especially fresh food purchases through the local grocery store. And so there are many different ways and programs that we're encouraging them to think about instead of just working with others who do the same thing as you, but working with others in your community who also purchase food. And how can we work better together?
There's another complication here, of course, with food distribution, particularly fresh food distribution. When I go to a supermarket and I'm buying a loaf of bread, I'm always checking. I'm going to the bakery area. I'm not going to the one where the bread could last for 2 years if you don't open the bag. I'm going to the fresh bakery area, and I'm looking at when it was baked and when it's, you know, what it's good for. So there are expiration dates on certain kinds of food products. And that would seem to really complicate this.
Well, at the federal level and at the state level, we're working to clarify those codes that are on food packages. Some of them are a matter of best quality rather than expiration.
There's a lot of confusion with that.
Right,
yes.
There's confusion on that.
Buy or don't
right.
use it after this.
Right, so we're working to clarify that, making sure that people understand that. Some of our rural groceries purchase food in the frozen form and sell it in the frozen form, and that seems to work pretty well, too, to help keep the food fresher longer. So addressing food waste and expiration dates are also ways that we can work on this together.
It would seem to me that this issue is not unique to North Dakota. There's lots of rural U.S. out there, and there are probably lots of ideas that are being explored. Is there kind of a greater coalition that that you work with, too, you know, sort of an idea bank that's existing and growing?
Yes, actually, we are connecting our work to the surrounding states. We have contacts in Minnesota, South Dakota, Montana, Idaho, Kansas. So we're trying to learn together, share together, not reinvent the wheel separately in every single state. But interestingly, the states that are feeling this first and foremost are the states that are the least populated. It's where you can feel the trends first. It's where it becomes feeling a little bit more desperate earlier than other states.
It would seem to me, too, Lori, that as a rural development director, I see newsletters from rural co-ops. You communicate with your customers, and this is a sort of a way to keep them in the loop about these developments, isn't it?
Exactly. And working for the electric and telecommunications cooperatives, we use our magazine quite a lot to make sure people understand this is a project that we're working on, we're interested in, we're concerned about.
Well, you've got your work cut out for you. Part of this, I think, from what I understand from the discussion so far, is that there are habits, behaviors that need to be altered a bit in order to make this work.
Yes, that is a part of it. And, you know, people talk about rural becoming cool again, that people are going to move back to rural areas and live there. And I believe that. I think that'll be true. And North Dakota is a fantastic place for that. You can telecommute quite easily in North Dakota because we have great broadband access in most areas. However, if we can't hold on to some of these basic amenities in our rural communities, people aren't going to be interested in moving there. They're going to look for at least access to food and health care, some of those basics.
Quality of life includes a little diversity at the dinner table.
Yes.
Well, we're going to pursue this, as I mentioned, for a few months now on Main Street with discussions about Hunger-Free North Dakota and the coalition that is supporting it and the various issues. For example, in April we'll talk about the summer food service program. You know, in the summer when school is out, people, kids, still need to eat healthy meals. So I want to thank you both for being with us today. Karen Ahrens is the coordinator of Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition, and she also is a health and nutrition consultant with a business called Ahrens Consulting. And Lori Sapo is a rural development director for the North Dakota Association of Rural Electric Co-ops. Lori, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And Karen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you to Prairie Public for this partnership.
Coming up, a commentary from Bruce Burke.
Shen Yun presents 5,000 Years of Civilization, combining ancient legends with technological innovations, historically authentic costumes, and storytelling. Through classical Chinese dance, Shen Yun shares diverse ethnic and folk traditions, filled with orchestral sound. May 5th at the Chester Fritz Auditorium in Grand Forks. One performance only. Tickets at shenyun.com. shenyun.com.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Bruce Berg used to teach English. He still writes and voices his commentaries from his home in Jamestown. Today, Bruce tackles the tidiness issue with a bit of human behavior. For his examples, he draws on a famous American general and contrasts his advice about getting things done with the habits of American writers of note. Here's his essay titled, Clean Desk.
William Manchester's biography of Douglas MacArthur expounds on the general in both praise and a touch or so of condemnation, as all good biographers do. Nobody gets away totally clean in an accurate story of a life, but the term clean does link with MacArthur. Now, I'm talking about the general's clean desk theory. MacArthur believed and practiced that if one closed desk work at midnight, or 3 a.m. for that matter, the desk should be clean of tasks, and the next day's paperwork should start from scratch whenever possible. Now, I follow MacArthur's approach to the empty desk, and I try within reason to maintain the clean desk, but too often I fall to the theory of John Updike, who claimed that desks want to be messy. They are full of contents that are crying for attention and should not be ignored. Updike wrote from three separate desks, all of which would have been frowned on by MacArthur. Desks are important to us. I find myself believing in MacArthur's approach, but probably following Updike's excuses. Getting things done and put away in proper places is a virtue. My mother's approach to late kitchen dishes was that no matter how tired she was, one washes and dries the last dish no matter how late it is. Writer John Irving writes the closing chapters of his novels first, a sort of clean desk writing. Photographer Jill Kremenz has taken over 1,500 photos of writers at work at their desks. Now, I haven't seen all of her work, but the ones I have seen, I don't remember any desks that would be approved by Good Housekeeping. So, where am I going with all this? Well, MacArthur is long gone. But are there any advocates of his discipline in the wee hours? Let me just say that if you follow MacArthur with the clean desk practice, you are to be commended. And if you follow Updike's approach, well, you've got company. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
If I cleaned my desk, I wouldn't be able to find anything. Coming up on Main Street, author Victoria Johnson talks about her book, American Eden. It will be one of the books featured at this week's National Book Award event at Concordia College. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Moody's Analytics didn't have very good news for North Dakota's agriculture economy.
It's very clear that the prices that we saw in 2012, 2013, those are not coming back.
That's what Dan White told members of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees. White said some uncertainty with trade deals as well as the strong U.S. dollar have kept prices down. North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring says White is probably correct on that. He says other countries have been filling demands for soybeans and wheat, and he says the value of the dollar remains an impediment.
It hurts agricultural commodities. It hurts manufactured goods. We can't compete in a global market when the value of our dollar is so high. And until that's adjusted, I don't foresee us moving prices up anytime soon.
Goring says he also hopes a trade deal will be worked out with China and other countries. He says traders want to know the rules of the road, even if the deal is not the best. Fargo City commissioners and staff have outlined preliminary plans for spring flooding response as the risk increases as a result of additional precipitation, a deep snowpack, and the spring thaw cycle that is running late. Another storm this week is expected to further increase flood worries.
There's no culverts open, there's no rivers open, there's no ditches open, there's no nothing open. So if the weather turns in a second to all of a sudden really hot weather, I'm afraid we're in trouble. And it's comforting to know that, and I think it's good for our community to know the preparation we have for that potentiality of it hitting us pretty hard this year. And let's hope it doesn't. But I'm sure you're all worried and preparing for the worst.
That was City Commissioner John Strand. City Administrator Bruce Grubb says the city is waiting for another flood outlook from the National Weather Service next week to provide a better idea of what could be expected and what the city would need to do. Last week's flood outlook indicated a 50% chance the Red River could hit almost 35 feet. And the CDC has reported that drug overdose deaths have decreased in North Dakota since a record number of 77 deaths were recorded in 2016. In 2017, 68 deaths were recorded for a decrease of 13.2%. Deaths had steadily increased since 2013 with 20 deaths, 43 deaths in 2014, and 61 deaths in 2015. Pam Segnis is director for the Behavioral Health Division of the North Dakota Department of Human Services. She says this decrease is the result of programs and efforts statewide to address opioid use prevention, treatment, and recovery. She says while this is a promising trend, work to educate on and prevent overdoses will continue.
The efforts we're doing are working. We need to stay consistent and continue implementing the efforts. We also recently were awarded an additional $4 million grant, which is called the State Opioid Response Grant. So we're going to be able to continue the efforts that we've already started, but also expand services and looking at providing better treatment services for individuals who are seeking recovery. That means peer support services and medication-assisted treatment. So we want to not just prevent overdoses, but also assist individuals in finding recovery.
Segna says one thing that's important to keep in mind is that people are more likely to overdose after a period of incarceration, hospitalization, or recent sobriety. She says it's important to keep access to naloxone widespread and open so those in a position to use it and help with overdoses can do so. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Next time on The Pulse.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
When disaster strikes, what are our best chances of survival?
Drop, cover, and hold on.
How do we prepare for the worst as communities?
Writing out plans, thinking through scenarios.
And individuals.
Having a water bottle in your purse at all times.
Dealing with disasters on The Pulse.
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Victoria Johnson. She's an associate professor of urban policy and planning for Hunter College in New York City, and she's also a finalist for nonfiction in the National Book Awards. And her book is American Eden, David Hossack, Botany and Medicine in the Garden of the Early Republic. Thanks for joining us, Victoria.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about the book you wrote that's a nonfiction finalist for a National Book Award.
Well, the book is American Eden. It's a biography of a man who was so famous during his lifetime that he was considered one of the most famous Americans. And today, almost no one has heard his name. His name was David Hossack, and he was, if you have heard of him today, it's probably for his role as the attending physician at the duel fought in July 1804 between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. But this book covers his eventful and dramatic life in many other arenas aside from that appearance at a very famous event in American history.
And people might have seen it in the musical Hamilton. He shows up in that show?
That's correct. He's not a named character in the program. You won't find his name, but he is played by one of the Corps members who's carrying a doctor bag in several critical scenes in the musical.
Now, the other reason we're speaking with you is that the 14th National Book Awards at Concordia College is later this week, Thursday and Friday, and there's an event on Thursday evening at 7:30 in the Centrum at the Knutson Campus Center at Concordia. It's free and open to the public. It's a reading and conversation, and you'll be there along with Sigrid Nunez. She's the author of the fiction winner for the National Book Award, The Friend. So welcome to the Upper Midwest. Have you been to our part of the country before?
Well, thank you. I have been close. I lived in Michigan for 13 years as a professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
All right. So you're coming in time, as my producer Skip Wood reminds me, for another winter blast.
Oh, good. Looking forward.
It's been an epic winter where we are, and you'll get a real taste of what we live through sometimes. Well, let's talk about David Husek. What made him such an interesting person for you to study and write about? And I know you're interested in botany.
Well, you know, he is one of the reasons I became so interested in botany. I love gardens, but I wasn't really planning to write a book about a botanist or about gardens. I was reading a book about the founding of the New York Botanical Garden, which is a very famous garden internationally, one of the top two gardens in the world, and it top three, I should say, and it was founded in the 1890s. I was reading about this garden, read about a precursor garden founded almost a century earlier, and that garden, I learned, this is about a decade ago that I learned about this, was founded on farmland in the heart of Manhattan Island that is today home to Rockefeller Center.
Wow, a big pile of bricks on top of what used to be pastoral land, huh?
Exactly, and this garden was founded by David Husek, a doctor I had never heard of, who wanted to create a public botanical garden. There was not such a thing in the United States at the time, in the Young Republic. This was 1801. He bought 20 acres of farmland and proceeded to spend over $1 million in today's dollars out of his own pocket to build a scientific research institution in which to conduct experiments on plants, which were the main source of medicine at that time.
So he would have been what we consider a Renaissance man because he was interested in other things just besides medicine.
Yes. In addition to being a Columbia professor of botany and medicine and founding this botanical garden, Husek, and this is one of the reasons he became so famous during his lifetime, he founded or co-founded over a dozen other institutions in New York City so that by the time he died, he was celebrated by the great American, you know, the figures we know today, Hamilton and Madison and Jefferson, and by the greatest European scientists, Alexander von Humboldt and Sir Joseph Banks, both admired him. So he was really very famous, and we've forgotten all about him.
And we've also sort of forgotten what this place was like at the time. We mentioned the fact that this was like farmland in the middle of Manhattan. Yes. Washington, D.C. was founded in a swamp, and this is right after the Revolutionary War, pretty much, you know, less than a generation later. So describe New York City in 1801.
Well, New York itself, the city was located at the very bottom of Manhattan Island in what is, you know, the toe of Manhattan.
What we call the Battery now?
Yeah, all clustered down around there. And Husek lived and worked in that area like almost everybody else, and he would have crossed paths as a boy and a teenager with the greats of the young United States, all the people I just listed, and because it was such a small city. And when he decided to found this botanical garden, he bought this 20-acre parcel 3.5 miles out of town. So he took a country lane called the Middle Road up the spine of the island by carriage or on horseback through farms and groves and meadows and arrived at this glorious piece of property from which he could see both rivers, and he could see all the way to New Jersey, and he could see all the way to the green fields of Long Island and the little town of Brooklyn.
So is this close to Broadway now?
Well, so this piece of land that then was covered with mountain laurel and viburnum and violets is now the middle road, that country lane, is now Fifth Avenue.
Oh, even better. Okay. Yeah. So how did he get to become a friend of Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr?
Yes, he was friends with both men. He was a young doctor in the 1790s. He had just come back from studying at the greatest medical faculty in the world, the University of Edinburgh, and studying botany in London. And he quickly began to be brought into the sick rooms of the wealthy and famous in New York City for his cutting-edge medical training. And the big event that brought him close to the Hamilton family was that in 1797, he saved the life of Eliza and Alexander Hamilton's eldest son, Philip, who was 15 years old at the time. This didn't make it into the musical, but Huzzack saved Philip Hamilton's life with the help of a medicinal plant, Peruvian bark. And from that moment on, he was the beloved friend of Hamilton, and they were incredibly grateful to him for saving Philip's life. He, around the same time, became the physician to Aaron Burr and Burr's adored daughter, Theodosia. Mm. So when the duel, when Burr and Hamilton became embroiled in the war of written words that led to the duel, Huzzack was the logical choice to be the attending physician.
Well, let's talk a bit about Peruvian bark. What were the medicinal properties of that?
Well, Peruvian bark, which is made from the cinchona tree native to the Andes. It was an imported medicinal plant. It was later identified to contain quinine, but that hadn't been isolated in Huzzack's day. It was isolated during Huzzack's lifetime. But in 1797, doctors knew only that it was the most potent medicinal plant available. And it was particularly effective against malaria, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But Huzzack found it useful in treating whatever it was Philip had, which was a terrible near-fatal fever, possibly typhus or scarlet fever.
Wow. So these medicinal plants are very much the pharmacopoeia for doctors of the time?
Yeah. And what Huzzack was really trying to do with this botanical garden was try to figure out what native species on this vast, largely unexplored continent of North America at the time, what native species might be discovered to have similar properties to some of these expensive and hard to import and impossible to grow exotic plants such as Peruvian bark. And so that's what he was trying to do with this medicinal garden, was to conduct scientific research. It was more like the NEH and the FDA and those kinds of institutions than a pretty city park.
Well, but it's intriguing because, of course, if you're doing the FDA or whatever, they got these painstaking tests that might go on for years. I mean, was he guesstimating? How did he know that a certain plant might work a certain way?
Well, they were really on the cutting edge of this research. So they were Huzzack and his students, he assembled a team of students, and they took the known medicinal plants, things like Peruvian bark, and conducted chemical experiments on them, on the leaves, on the bark, on the stems and flowers, and watched the reactions. And then they conducted the same exact experiments on native species, and they tried to figure out the chemical components of these plants. And that was really some of the first systematic pharmaceutical research in the United States, what Huzzack was doing at this garden. They also, yes, tried them out on their patients. The protocols were not as strict at the time.
Yeah.
And Huzzack tried them out on himself. So he conducted a lot of medical experiments on his own body.
Well, I assume they knew something about poppies at the time.
Yes, they knew poppies were used as sedatives. You know, the medicinal plants, the thing to know about them is that we, in the 1790s and the dawn of the 19th century, the theory of the human body that was still held sway was the humoral theory, the idea that the body needed to be, a sick body was out of balance and it needed to be brought back into balance. And the way you did that was by purging or sometimes bloodletting. Hasek was not a huge fan of bloodletting.
Good.
yes. And so they were trying to find medicinal plants that would sort of regulate the bodily fluids and solids in an attempt to get the body back into equilibrium. And a lot of these plants had those kinds of properties. They would slow down the nervous system or speed it up or, you know, purge the body of what were thought to be offending fluids.
We call those laxatives, don't we?
Or... Yes. Yes, that's one word for them. And what's important to note is that if all of this seems kind of primitive, is that it was cutting edge at the time, and this is in just decades and decades before germ theory. So Hussack and his colleagues were working without the understanding of the kind of microbes that would later be identified in the late 19th and even into the 20th century as causing these illnesses they were trying to cure.
So how did they use the plants, actually? Did they create some sort of essence, a tincture with alcohol, or how did they actually apply to the patient?
A wide variety. Some of them would be made into a salve. Some would be a tincture. Some would be an infusion. There was a lot of drinking of teas that would make you vomit.
okay.
And
a medic.
Yes, and emetics. And so it was. They came in many, many different forms. Sometimes it was a powder that you soaked in a steaming bath with a very strong powder. Kind of concentrate from the plant. Many different possibilities.
Well, you said you'd stumbled across this fellow, David Hussack, a few years ago. As an educator and a scientist and a well-known physician of his time, he must have left a fair amount of papers, didn't he? Or was there a paper trail for this book?
Yes, there was a paper trail. I'm laughing because that paper trail took, 8 years to follow and write about, and took me to over 30 archives in the U.S. and Europe.
Wow.
The paper trail was in many different directions geographically, and it was so exciting to follow that. And the thrill of archival research is, it's hard to beat if you love it, because you go into an archive and something, a document is brought to you, and it's this sense of discovery and thrill. It can take a while if there's not a published critical edition of somebody's papers. And in Hussack's case, because he had been forgotten and because, as you say, he was a Renaissance man and scattered across many different domains, his papers ended up all over the place. So I did spend many years reconstructing his life out of the archives.
Victoria Johnson is an associate professor of urban policy and planning and an authority on botanical gardens. We're talking about her book, which has been nominated for a National Book Award. And that book is American Eden, David Hussack, Botany and Medicine in the Garden of the Early Republic. So when you were investigating the writings of David Hussack, were you doing this for an academic paper, or did you think early on, oh, this is going to be a book?
I immediately knew I wanted to write a book about this man that would reach a curious reading public. He had such an extraordinary life, and he watched the transformation of his nation and indeed contributed to it, and he watched the transformation of Manhattan Island.
Well, Victoria, you said that David Hussack saw the transition of Manhattan Island into something that it has become today. In our current concerns around the globe are with climate change, and that must be affecting the plant diversity, the species, the kinds of things that David Hussack would be very interested in terms of what applications they might have besides just growing someplace.
Yes, and to track the changes in the species that are growing around Manhattan. And I know a lot of people don't think of Manhattan as filled with plant species, but in fact there are many. And there is a wonderful project of the New York Botanical Garden called the Ecoflora Project that is led by a botanist named Daniel Atha, and he's mapping with citizen scientists who go out and do observations each month of particular species. He's mapping all of the sightings of a whole range of species to try to build a map, a chronological sequence of what plants are still with us and what might be regaining ground after some conservation efforts around the island and the surroundings. So citizen scientists are out in droves every month keeping track of these plants, and a number of New York City sites are trying to, as is the case in cities all over the world, trying to reincorporate some of the lost nature into more urban settings. And New York is definitely involved in that process. And I think we might see Rockefeller Center getting more involved in that process. I'm working on a fantastic project right now that I'm really excited about, which is a digital virtual reality reconstruction of the Elgin Botanic Garden that you will be able to traverse as a viewer and feel what Manhattan felt like, looked like 200 years ago. So at least virtually, we'll be able to walk back through the Elgin Botanic Garden.
I look forward to that opportunity. Now, let's talk about botanical gardens in general. They're not just pretty places to go, are they? There are lots of them around the world and plenty of them in the United States. But what is their function besides being an attraction for visitors?
Botanical gardens are indeed stunning places to spend an afternoon or attend a wedding, but you're right, they do so much more. And they are becoming more and more engaged in public education about climate change. So their relevance is growing and growing each month. They conduct education programs for adults and children. They are now involved, many of them, in teaching urban agriculture. And the larger gardens have robust scientific research institutions that might be conducting some of the pharmacological research of the type that David Husick was conducting. And they're sending botanists out all over the world to try to map and save plant species that are under threat of eradication from urban sprawl. And they are very involved in seed banking, so preserving specimens that might otherwise go extinct.
There's one question I've been dying to ask since we talked about the Hamilton Burr duel. Since Husick was a friend of both, was his friendship with Burr affected by the outcome of the duel?
Astonishingly, they stayed very close for the rest of their lives. And the reason for this is, I mean, most of us, if one friend killed another, we might have trouble being friends, remaining friends. Duels were, you know, a kind of ritual affair, and although Husick was extremely devastated by the loss of his admired friend Hamilton, he lived by a principle of scientific neutrality. He once said to a friend, "Science knows not party politics." Might sound a little strange to our ears today, but he believed that science was the pursuit of science was the ultimate value. And so in his medical practice, as in his scientific research, he was friends with and collaborated with people across the political spectrum of his day. And this allowed him to stay close with Aaron Burr for the rest of their lives. And he, when Burr fled to Europe several years later, Husick was the one whom Burr entrusted with the care of his daughter Theodosia, who was ill at the time.
Victoria Johnson is the author of American Eden, David Husick, Botany and Medicine in the Garden of the Early Republic. She'll be engaged in a reading and conversation with the author's event Thursday evening at 7:30 in the Centrum at the Knutson Campus Center. This is open to the public, and Victoria will also be conducting a two-day residency on the Concordia campus. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Dakota Date Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, Fargo Film Festival director Emily Beck previews the upcoming 19th Annual Fargo Film Festival with all the sights and sounds, and we'll have film clips from the winning films next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 12th. Cornelius Hagerman Foreman was not a young man when he gathered a group of friends and family from Michigan, along with a load of lumber, and struck out to establish a town in eastern Dakota Territory. Colonel Foreman was 55 and had already started another town named for him in Michigan. But Foreman, North Dakota, was to be an even greater chapter. Foreman was born in New Brunswick, Canada. He came to live in Michigan after working in farming, mercantile, and lumber businesses in Canada. He had also served in the military in Ontario. He was struck by a train as a young man and afterward wore a prosthetic leg. Foreman came to Dakota Territory in 1882 and bought land in Sargent County. He and his family and friends began to build in Center Township, which was renamed Foreman. The load of lumber was used to build a general store, the Foreman family home, and a number of other houses. Foreman successfully sought the title of county seat for the town and eventually built the Sargent County Courthouse after donating the land. By statehood, in 1889, the town had several hotels, law offices, stores, a dentist, and even two newspapers. The railroad also came to town. Colonel Foreman served in several roles as Justice of the Peace, Town Clerk, and Township Supervisor. Colonel Foreman and his wife, Adeline, had seven children. His wife died in 1895 from a stroke. Colonel Foreman then lived with his son, Harry. Having spent most of his money, he was poor in his final years. He died from complications of a paralytic stroke on this date in 1923 at the age of 96. At his funeral, school children marched to the Congregational Church on a cold and blustery day to stand at attention while a bell tolled 96 times to honor the town's founder. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Wednesday on Main Street, the cost of care late in life can be daunting, and we'll talk about the price tag for long-term care with AARP's Kathleen Uveri and Mike Chaussey. We'll get an update on what could be an epic March storm from Weather Service meteorologist Greg Gust. And we'll preview the Fargo Film Festival with a Prairie Pulse television show excerpt featuring Emily Beck. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.